This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, Gaius, and I welcome Marco Vlejos, Germanicus. It is idle along the Thames. It is 90 AD in Londinium, a prosperous new village, new town, ambitious town, at the edge of the Roman Empire. Domitian is our emperor. The town is filled with retired centurions and their wives. The children are happy. We do not need a wall as of yet, despite the unhappiness of Boudicca's raid in easy memory, because the centurions are here and the tribes are way to the north of us and have been tamed by several Roman armies. However, we do have the skill, the power, the curse of being able to see into the future as well as the past. We're educated men. Idle, however, our cup of wine. We're not senatorial class. We can't afford it. We're equus class, meaning we're not asked to fight anymore, but we are asked to contribute to war fighting, and we pay our share. We sacrifice at the right temples. We certainly sacrifice to the great god Augustus. We worry about the Roman army on the Danube. But right now, our concerns focus on the contest in the 21st century between the Russian Federation, led by Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin, and NATO, led by the United States and the White House. The contest looks to be over Ukraine. However, in these last days, the Kremlin has moved to expand its reach for troops to fight in Ukraine. At the same time, made it very clear that the war is on the eve of escalating in a fashion that is not entirely predictable. So we look to Mr. Putin's speech for hints as to where this is going from Moscow's point of view. Germanicus, I read from Mr. Putin's speech in part. This is the historical analysis that seems pertinent to what Moscow believes is Washington's error of ways for the 20th century. It begins. The United States is the only country in the world that has used nuclear weapons twice, destroying the cities of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Japan. He goes on to say, recall that during World War II, the United States and Britain reduced Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, and many other German cities to rubble without the least military necessity. It was done ostentatiously and, to repeat, without any military necessity. They had only one goal, as with the nuclear bombing of Japanese cities, to intimidate our country and the rest of the world. He adds, the United States left a deep scar in the memory of the people of Korea and Vietnam with their carpet bombings and use of napalm and chemical weapons. It actually, the United States, continues to occupy Germany, Japan, the Republic of Korea, and other countries, which they, the United States, cynically refer to as equals and allies. Look now, what kind of alliance is that? The president of Russia asked rhetorically. I'll stop there, Germanicus. What do you make of that analysis of the conduct of the United States over a broad span of time, several wars, many presidents, and the American people prosperous the whole time? Good evening to you.
Good evening, Gaius. The leader of Russia has made an adroit argument. It's adroit in the sense that in the post-Soviet world that Russia inhabits, Russia is free of any claim that the Soviet Union, a past, had made equally great transgressions as the United States today represents. Also, it's adroit in the sense that he is speaking to those who, if they do not support Russia, at least are unwilling to toe the line and kowtow and submit to U.S. dictates. And in fact, given their own long historical legacies of colonialism and imperialism, of course, China talks about the century of humiliation. India had been, if not prostrate, then complicit with all of its princes in a totally degrading experience under British rule. The African states have had it up to their neck. And of course, in Latin America, we all know the conquistadores and the oppression that was visited upon, you know, the native peoples of that entire ecumene. So what you have essentially is 80% of the world receptive to the appeal that Putin is making, that in fact the U.S. represents the end point, as it were, of a long glide path of Western and European imperialism and oppression of peoples. And given American behavior, not simply since the 1890s, the Spanish-American War, but more pointedly to the barely concealed, you know, fig leaf colonialism after World War II of essentially creating an empire in Europe and Japan, Philippines, and elsewhere, in which American troops were the quote-unquote visitors defending these countries from the evil Soviet Union. And yet, given the end of the Soviet Union, they're still there. And it represents, in effect, kind of colonial occupation, as Putin represents, that is very hard to really dismiss or deny. So effectively, also, given American moves in the immediate wake of World War II to create an economic order after Bretton Woods, in which the U.S. was the privileged center of the world economy and could dictate how other countries could behave economically, even to the extent that they might be at any moment cut out of the banking system, using the IMF, for example, and all sorts of other levers to create a world in submission to the U.S. And we have to remember, too, that Putin's call is made more powerful by the arrogance of the U.S. after the fall of the Soviet Union, in which there was no restraint on U.S. Dominance, U.S. hyperpower, or what was sometimes called ultrapower, in which the United States felt completely unconstrained. And that is shown quite effectively in the U.S. intervention in Ukraine and the way in which the U.S. casually, even contemptuously, discarded promises made to Putin's predecessor, Boris Yeltsin, that NATO would not expand. And in fact, those promises were thrown out. And not only were they thrown out, but the U.S. conducted a very aggressive campaign to oust Russia from any influence in Ukraine and to create a NATO-Ukraine that would be a kind of entering wedge into toppling Putin and reforming Russia itself, perhaps even breaking Russia up into constituent republics that would be more submissive, weaker, and yet represent the American vision of popular sovereignty. In other words, the U.S. had embarked on an all-out Roman approach to ruling the world. And this was quite evident, and it was something that Americans trumpeted, a triumphalist sort of vision that was coin of the realm after 9/11. And effectively, I believe, because I experienced it as you did, as we all did, it went to our heads. And Americans believed that they were the second coming, that they could create a new world order based on the American exceptionalist vision of world redemption. And that redemption involved erasing all remaining quote-unquote corrupt regimes and bringing the world under one vision, an American vision, which was, you know, a concept that was, or it was basically keying off of original American ideas of democracy and liberty. But
Germanicus, you remind me of that moment when Hirohito, the emperor of Japan, on his white stallion rode to the cheers of a crowd following, I believe, the victory in Singapore. And they, at the time the analysis was Japan would continue to roll across the Pacific, even to speculate about invading America. Why not? Our soldiers have never been blunted. Later on, the Japanese analysis and critical analysis of what went wrong was that all of Japan had victory disease.
That's a very powerful point, because that emerged very quickly, because before Pearl Harbor, Japan in the early Showa period was intensely insecure. And one of the reasons, the main reason, in fact, that Japan launched the attack on Pearl Harbor and on the British in Southeast Asia was their tremendous fear that they would be destroyed by the American oil, scrap and steel embargoes that were going to throttle the Japanese economy. And yet, because of their incredible success in the first few months of the Pacific War, they were seized by a vision that they could actually do things like seize Hawaii, which was a major element in Japanese planning. And there's much that has been written about that. And also to take India, and they were at the borders of India.
Yes,
they were in Assam province.
The Kido
they didn't
Butai,
make it, but
the Kido Butai
they were raid, very close.
The Kido Butai raided against Ceylon.
Before the Kido Butai and the Coral Sea.
I just wanted to mention, when you talked about American presumption, that's victory disease. That's what you're talking about.
Right, but the victory disease in the U.S., is more worrisome than that of Japan, because when the Japanese bubble was burst at Midway and then at Guadalcanal, it was over. And the Japanese were scrambling and desperate. But the U.S. Has had a kind of long, I wouldn't even say a plateau. It's been more like an ascending moment that's been extended for decades. Remember, the Soviet Union came apart in 1990 and 1991, and then the U.S. has had 30 years and more since then when it has been unchallenged. And in effect, by pushing Russia to respond as it has, and I would argue that is the dynamic here in this war, by going too far, by pushing Russia as it has, the U.S. has suddenly created an opposition that it thought impossible and is now confronted with the same sort of thing the Japanese were. And yet, to the Americans, to us, it is all the more unimaginable, because we have been so long basking.
All right, let's look at Putin's condemnation. Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, carpet bombing of Korea and Vietnam. Germanicus, there's nothing wrong with that analysis, is there?
No. Effectively, the U.S. Strategic bombing did have some war-winning effects. But the United States was all in on absolutely destroying German and Japanese society. And in fact, there's one terrible moment in December of 1945, which is, as you know, months after the war ended. Gallup ran a poll, and Americans responded. A third of Americans were still angry that we had not dropped more nuclear weapons on Japan. That shows you how deeply existential the war had been and how willing Americans were to embrace the destruction of enemy societies. Now, and I don't think it's any different now. When the Secretary of Defense calls for bringing Russia to its knees, and as the president has done, talking about how Mr. Putin must go, this is World War II talk. It's kind of doubling back on the World War II narrative in a situation that is in no way comparable to what the U.S. faced in the 1940s.
All right, let's talk about the call to arms. I'm speaking in 90 AD, and we're looking into the future. Mr. Putin's historical analysis leaves out major factors, leaves out the Lend-Lease, leaves out Stalin, leaves out the Ribbentrop Pact with Molotov that essentially divided up a Poland that was then sacrificed, massacred by both Germany and Russia, leaves all that out.
Right.
Focuses on the misconduct of the United States foreign policy. All right, that's fine. But what he does talk about, the U.S. stands condemned. I don't know any serious historian these days that vouchsafes for Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne. He doesn't mention, Gaius, the firebombing of Tokyo in March of 45. He might have. He doesn't go into Agent Orange over Vietnam. He might have. So while Mr. Putin has a prosecution witness complaint, he is not fair-minded about his own country. Nonetheless, that's not his job. He's speaking as the emperor. And when we come back, what does the emperor ask of his troops? This is the Friends of History Debating Society. We're in Londinium, 90 AD, comfortably at the edge of the Roman Empire. The might of Rome protects us. We have reason to be philosophical because we're not called upon to make any particular contribution to the war effort over there in the Danube, far away. But we are watching what we could say is alarming and unpredictable in the 21st century because we've been here before. When an emperor makes a call to arms speech that has no limits, he means it. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.